Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. I just want to thank you all for being here tonight. Special segment tonight. I really am so excited to welcome Daryl James to the stage. So Daryl has a extensive background, 25 years, actually over that, with the FBI as a special agent. He was also the assistant team leader on the Dallas SWAT team for the FBI. And more pertinent, really, for today's discussion, Daryl James was a captain in the Marines. And I really want to thank, first of all, Daryl for his amazing commitment to serve our country. He also was a combat vet in the war in, I want to make sure I get this war right. This is really embarrassing because I should know it right off the top of my head. Gulf War veteran. I wanted to say the name exactly right. Gulf War veteran. So has really served our country, and we thank him. But before we get started, I just wanted to mention what our case is about tonight. We're going to be focusing on Daniel Penny. Now, Daniel Penny was charged with manslaughter and various other charges regarding what occurred on May 1st, 2023, when he subdued a passenger that was aboard the F train in New York, the subway. Specifically, this passenger, according to witnesses, came on board the train and was screaming, was very out of control. I have one of the quotes that one of the individuals said, and that was, quote, "I will kill you." Bystanders were, of course, very upset, very alarmed. In court today, we actually heard from one 19-year-old who took a video of the incident, who was absolutely traumatized and afraid, very nervous and concerned, and she testified about that. Daniel Penny and actually other passengers worked to subdue the passenger that was causing the ruckus, if you will, that was screaming. A lot of passengers were very upset, and some felt a great deal of fear. Having said that, the chokehold he was put in lasted approximately 3 minutes. It resulted in Mr. Neely becoming unconscious, and ultimately he passed on after the injury, if you will, that he suffered as a result of the chokehold. Although we did hear last week that first responders, particularly officers, had a pulse when they arrived on scene, but did not want to administer CPR because they felt that Mr. Neely was a drug user, and they feared getting AIDS if they participated in administering CPR. So that's where we're at. That's the thumbnail sketch. I want to bring up Daryl James now to discuss. Welcome, DJ.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, it's so great to see you. And I really appreciate you coming on with us tonight, because I thought it was really important to get a perspective from a former Marine. We will never say ex-Marine. You know I know better than that, DJ. But from a former Marine who, you know, served in the Marines in the Gulf War, who was trained as Marine, actually rose to the rank of captain. And if I could, I know you're very familiar with this case, but if you could give me a sense of, from Daniel Penny's point of view, just give me an overall sense of what you think transpired and why.
Yeah, so it, obviously very interesting case, right? And typical, anybody who's been on the subway in New York knows, right? Anything could happen at any time. You get a lot of different people on there. But from his perspective, and the accounts, obviously, that I've read, right, media accounts, you know, like you were saying earlier, you had Gordon Neely get on the train, immediately becomes, again, confronting some of the passengers, screaming at some of the passengers. And, you know, some of the quotes I said was, I'll kill, or things like that, right? So, obviously, passengers are afraid. He's, Daniel Penny's on the train. And so he's seeing this. And again, typical New York, everybody just tries to avoid it, ignore it, right? That's usually what happens on the subway in New York. Somebody's just being loud and you just try to go about your business. And eventually, and I don't know how long this takes, but Neely approaches, I think it was a young woman, had a baby, and she was using actually the baby carriage to actually block Neely from getting to her. He starts screaming at her, and I think that's when Penny actually, grabs him and applies the hold to him, and you know they end up on the ground. So, you know, he's reacting, right? He's trying to obviously defend this woman. I mean, like I said, most of the passengers, I'm sure, were just trying to ignore it, right? Just don't look at him, don't say anything to him. Hopefully, he'll shut up, or he'll get off, or I'll get off at the next stop, and this will be over. But once that happened, obviously Penny felt he had to act because you're talking about a young woman and a baby. So he felt that he had to act. And his action was, again, from the accounts I read, he grabbed him from behind and applied the hold. And one thing I think your listeners should know is, so I see this all the time in the media, right? They talk about chokeholds. And that's what said that was applied. You and I in the Marine Corps, in the FBI, we're not taught a chokehold, right? We were taught a carotid restraint, which is typically what law enforcement is taught because it looks very similar. And obviously, I can't demonstrate it here, but it's the same thing. You put your arm around somebody's neck, you're holding them back. The difference is the arm pressure, the forearm, doesn't go across the front of the throat like you think of a chokehold where the forearm is across the front and you're pulling back on someone's neck. Actually, the elbow is in the front, which leaves a gap, and the forearm and the upper arm, the bicep, go on the sides of the neck to stop blood flow through the carotid artery to the brain, which makes them go unconscious, right? It puts them to sleep, basically, which is the purpose of that hold. And so whenever in the media you hear it's always called a chokehold, but it's not a chokehold. It's really, if done correctly, it's a carotid restraint. Now, in these cases, and I think there was a case in New York, Eric Garner, right, in 2014, police officer grabbed him, choked him, same type of situation. The hold wasn't applied correctly. Garner ends up dying because he couldn't breathe. And usually what happens is either the airway is cut off or the trachea can be smashed. If you apply enough force using the forearm. So I think people need to know that it's a carotid restraint is the proper hold to use in that situation.
You know, I love this point you bring up, Daryl. Whenever I'm teaching self-defense, this is something we practice, believe it or not because it needs to be used, but rather to understand how it feels and right. How quickly, when you have your carotid artery shut off, how quickly you lose consciousness. And actually, you brought up a great idea, and I'm going to do it with a soda can that I have here. So the point he was trying to point out, if this is somebody's neck, and this is a very scrawny neck, about like mine, if you're going to use this, you actually take the elbow, and it's applied like this, where it actually squeezes right here on the neck and closes down the carotid artery, which stops the flow of blood to the head in your brain, which causes unconsciousness, sometimes within a very short amount of time. DJ, were you with the academy when the instructor was instructing this to a class and had a student come up, and the student actually passed out. I don't know if you were there.
I don't think I was there when that happened, but I could see, I mean, yeah, it doesn't take long, and it doesn't take a tremendous amount of force, right, to pinch off those arteries and shut off that blood flow. So it doesn't, and that's why they teach it to law enforcement, right? You don't have to be some big, strong person to do it. Anybody can do it. It's very effective, and it doesn't cause permanent damage.
Yeah, no, exactly right. And personally, I used it in law enforcement. Somebody of my stature, to me, it was the go-to move. I had to arrest somebody and, you know, chase them down. And I literally jumped on their back and wrapped my legs around their waist because they were large. And I put them directly in that carotid restraint, different than the chokehold. And quite frankly, they went down very quickly. And it works very well for people of small stature because, like you said, it takes no force. It's actually leveraging against the carotid arteries.
Right.
So, DJ, did you have a chance to review the actual film? I was wondering what your thoughts were about his application of the carotid hold.
No, you know, I was looking for that. I didn't see... And I was going to ask you, but I hadn't actually seen his application of it. Like, I go back to the Garner case again. There is it's a picture taken from the video of the officer applying, and you can see his forearm is right across the front of the neck. And so you can see it is actually, he's choking the person, right? Because as you just demonstrated, there wasn't that gap that you leave where your elbow is right in front of the neck, and that gap where the airway remains open. Instead, the forearm is pushing up against the neck, and the tighter you squeeze, obviously, eventually you're going to shut off the airflow. I didn't see that. So in that case, is Penny applying it incorrectly or correctly?
From what I saw, it was applied correctly. It looked like in what you could see, obviously, they're on the ground. It's a struggle. I've watched it numerous times. There's actually another bystander, DJ, that's there kind of holding down Jordan Neely, assisting and kind of getting him under control because he's struggling. And during the application, the difference I see is Neely is actually using his off arm to apply that pressure more firmly.
Right.
And I know personally for me, that was something I just didn't do. I didn't use this, my off arm, to make it even tighter. Just applying it correctly was plenty of force. And
right.
It was the only thing I saw. So it almost served as a vice.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing. And as you know, like you said, you've done it, actual application of it, not just in training. When you do it in training, obviously a sterile environment, and you apply it correctly, you make sure you get that elbow right up in front, and you pull the person's head back, and obviously they don't pass out, they tap out before they pass out. Right. But when you're actually applying it in a real life situation, a struggle or a fight, the person's moving. They're not staying exactly where you apply it. So if you start off with the correct, right, with the elbow up front, you can easily end up because they're going to move and try to get out. And so if they move, they're sliding down your forearm, but you're not letting go of that fork, right? You're probably increasing the force because you're trying to keep them from getting away from you. And so even if you initiate it correctly, it could quickly go bad because it's a struggle. It's not a, you know, sterile environment where it's a situation where you've got somebody demonstrating on somebody else.
Right, and we haven't seen the toxicology report yet for Jordan Neely, but according to eyewitnesses, he was acting out of his mind. And Jordan Neely had been arrested 40 other times in his life for all sorts of violations and issues. And so he was no stranger to drug usage. And you know how it is, DJ, whenever you had to arrest somebody that you knew was a known drug user or that you didn't know, but then the way they acted during the arrest, you knew they were a drug user. it's a whole different level of concern.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, you're going to have that now. And what's interesting about this, too, is, you know, there's the possibility that there's apparently there was some mental health issues. Right. With Jordan Neely. Now, obviously, Daniel Penny wouldn't have known any of this because he didn't know him. So he's trying to defend someone on the subway. Right. In that instance. And he takes action because he thinks that person is in danger. Right. And so what he does is he's trying to defend her. Now, I think the biggest thing is going to be, and I think you said it earlier, the length of time that he had it in the home. Like, that's going to be kind of the bone of contention of why did you hold him? And I've read reports where it was 5 minutes, or the DA's office said 6 minutes, you know, and you just said three. So it could be, you know, any time. Usually these holds aren't meant to be applied that long. Now, in that situation, once you get into that circumstance, you're fighting with somebody, you're not going to let them go until there's somebody else there to control them, right? Or they stop fighting, right? And that's what we don't know. Like you said, there were two other people there who were also helping Kenny control you, right? So their testimony is going to be key, I think, in this whole deal, because if they say, well, he was resisting up until, right, somebody else showed up. So you're not going to release somebody. If you're in a real fight, you're not going to just let them go, because you know if you let them go, then you got to fight them all over again. It's not going to, or there's a good possibility you got to fight them all over again.
No, you're exactly right. And I think unless people have actually been in the throes of a street fight or in the throes of a fight of any sort, where it's really what you're thinking, it's your life. I'm not trying to get too dramatic because, you know, there were no weapons here, but Daniel Penny didn't know that. Nobody knew that.
Right. And that's another thing. Yeah. He didn't know. He Neely could have had a knife, right? He could have had a weapon. I mean, he doesn't know that. So once you have control, you want to maintain control until there's somebody else there to take control. Somebody else, usually being the police, like they shows up and takes control of the situation. So you're not going to let them go until either you or the other two guys were there, could have grabbed his arms, right, get behind his back, whatever. But we've got this person under control until the authorities get here. Because if you let him up, like I said, the fear is, okay, now we're right back in the fight. Like, this guy's not going, he's going to come back at me. So I've got the advantage, and I'm going to maintain the advantage until somebody shows up.
Well, I think in these circumstances, it's so easy to want to Monday morning quarterback. Oh, well, he should have done this, and he should have let go at this time and all of this. But, you know, talk to us a little bit about, you know, the adrenaline and what's going on in your mind, especially from the standpoint, not law enforcement, because that's so much different than a combat vet, than somebody in the military, because I think the military mindset is different from the law enforcement officer. Talk about that a little bit, DJ.
Yeah, so definitely, right? So military mindset is, you know, you're trained, as they trained me in the Marine Corps, close with and destroy the enemy, right? So when you say destroy, it's a nice word to kill, right? Let's say what it is, right? That's your job as a soldier, Marine, Airman, Sailor. You know, that's what you're trained to do, right? You're trying to figure out how to do that. Again, like you said, different from law enforcement, where you're trained, even in a situation that, like you described, where you had to grab somebody, right, and put them in a carotid restraint, you're trained to get control of the situation, right, to stop that person from doing whatever they're doing, just to get control of the situation, not trying to kill them. Now, unfortunately, that may be what happens if you can't get control of it, but you're trying to get control of that situation at that time, get control of that person, right, so you can take them into custody. And that's a whole different mindset, because as a Marine, like you say, you're taught to destroy the enemy. Now, obviously, that's his training. You can't do that on the streets of New York, right? You've got to modify that, because he's not in combat, and two, he's no longer a Marine. He's a private citizen on the subway. So he has to modify that, but he's going to use his training in order to try to gain control of that situation. And again, you know, he was acting out as a Marine would do, right? You're taught to defend, right? He's defending that person or himself against Neely because he feels that Neely is placing them in some type of danger. And so that's going to be his argument, I'm sure. Like, I thought she was in danger. I thought all the passengers, by the way he was acting. And I'm sure the defense will bring on witnesses along the subway to say, I felt like I was in danger. I didn't know what he was going to do. And I was glad somebody acted, right? That's the defense, I'm sure, that they're going to put on to say that he helped out everybody. I mean, he was just trying to help. He wasn't trying to kill the person. He wasn't trying to kill Mr. Neely. He was just trying to stop him from doing what he was doing.
Well, we know, DJ, that Daniel Penny was young. He was a 20-year-old young man, a sergeant in the Marines. And I just want to ask, I mean, how hard would that be? You're on the subway, you see this person that obviously he felt was a threat. Other passengers felt threatened. There was a baby or a young child in a stroller. There was all of this going on. I mean, we know about training, DJ. You've been through even more training than me with everything with the Marines. I mean, there is a training mindset where literally what you do kicks in. Talk to us about that.
In that situation, it's very difficult, right? Like I said, I mean, obviously you don't get on the subway that day expecting you're going to encounter somebody and you're going to have to try to restrain them. You're trying to get somewhere. And then all of a sudden this happens and your instincts and training for Daniel Penny as a Marine kick in, right? And he took and to take action, because let's face it, there are a lot of people that wouldn't take action. Right, because it's not the easiest thing to do, because you don't want to get involved, or I just want to get out of here, leave this alone. It'll be a funny story I'll tell when I get to where I'm going or whatever. But then he thought, like I said, he's gonna think that something bad is really about to happen. If I don't do something to prevent it, then this woman may get assaulted. Right, and again, she's standing there, she's holding her baby. He can't necessarily defend herself, right? If it had been somebody else, that a male or somebody, he may not have acted. He may just said, hey, let's shoo him away, just like I'm going to shoo him away. But when you saw that, that caused him to act. And like you said, he did what he was trained to do. I got to get this guy away from her before he hurts her. And that's part of the training. That's people who do those types of jobs, right? Military, law enforcement, that's the thing that you have in you, that at some point you gotta take action, even if nobody else is taking that.
Yeah, it's sort of it's really the oath, and I think it comes even deeper than that. The whole reason why you get involved in law enforcement or why you want to serve your country is this kind of innate sense that's what you want to do with your life. And
right.
It's not something you turn on and you turn off. It's something that's with you daily. I guarantee you, DJ, right now, if you saw something like this, I think you would snap right into action. What do you think, DJ?
Yeah, I mean, you always hope that, and when I look at the situation, and my first thought is, having a wife, having two daughters that are, young women, but I would hope somebody would defend them. And I would hope, like you said, I would do the same thing if I'm in that position and I see somebody else that maybe I don't even know, but if they're in that position, yeah, I need to step in and intervene because I don't want to see her, right, get assaulted. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, I would hope I would step in and do that and act and do something to try to defuse the situation, whatever I could to keep him from assaulting her, as I thought that's what was going to happen. And I would hope somebody else would do it. If it was my wife or my kids in that same situation, that somebody would step in and help them out. I mean, that's what we all hope, right?
And I want to mention too here, because I don't, obviously, your background and everything you've gone through in your life, you're going to more... Daniel Penny is going to be somebody that you can relate to because of your background. But I do want to say a word for Jordan Neely. I think all of us feel terrible for this situation and the result and the fact that Mr. Neely lost his life as the result, likely, of this confrontation. But I found it very interesting, DJ, that according to first responders, meaning law enforcement that came on scene, he had a pulse when they arrived, and they just didn't want to do CPR because they were worried. They said, quote, he was dirty. They were afraid of AIDS. They didn't want to do mouth to mouth, even though really CPR is more about circulating the blood. That's
what's right.
giving him two breaths. When we're thinking about that, I mean, from a legal standpoint, if you were presenting this case to a district attorney, how do you think that plays in and how this got charged when really he was seemingly alive?
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, only thing I've read from the coroner's report is that they ruled the death a homicide, right? That's I think that's what I read from the coroner's report, which means homicide just means you died because of somebody else's act versus a suicide, right? Where you died from your own actions or accidental or natural causes or whatever. So, but the fact that he was breathing, and like you said, the first responders didn't intervene is very interesting. And I hadn't heard much about that, right? That they got there. He still has a pulse. They're not giving him CPR. Like you said, even just, you know, the pumping of the heart to make sure the blood is flowing. That's going to be, again, all those things are going to come into play. And so if you're presenting this to a DA from the prosecution side of it, and you want to say, well, Daniel King's responsible for his death, he was the one who applied the hold, and it's, a lot is going to be determined, like you said, toxicology reports. What is the coroner going to say was the final cause of his death? Was it the lack of air to the brain? Was it something in his system that reason? I mean, what was it that actually finally caused it? Because you know, the case, the Eric Garner case that I mentioned earlier, those police officers or the police officers who applied the hold did not get prosecuted for that. I think they were going to, and then eventually the charges got dropped, but they ended up not prosecuting that police officer. So, and I almost, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum, right? I want to say, of course, this is New York City. And so you go back and, you know, those incidents happened, I think it was almost 9 years apart. The one was 2014, 2023. So, but I'm sure when those prosecutors were weighing charging Penny, right, that had to come up because it was a big deal at the time, right? There were protests. It was a big deal when that police officer didn't get charged in the Garner case. So, you know, again, nothing happens in a vacuum. So it's something that had to be weighing on them to say, we've got a chance now to go the other way and charge the individual in this. So it's, you know, and now, of course, Jennifer, like you, I'm on both sides of it, right? As a private investigator, sometimes I work for the defense. So you're looking at the other side of the case. So it's going to be interesting to see how all of this plays out. And yeah, it's a very difficult case, right? It's so close on both sides. On one side, you say, you know, you never want to see anybody get killed in this manner. But on the other side, you say, well, right? He comes on the train, he initiates all this, although there's no, from what I've read at least, no physical contact. I don't think he physically assaulted any of the passengers on the train, but it was the fear, right? That his actions caused the fear that made Penny react. So this is going to be a really interesting case to see how it finally gets adjudicated and what the jury decides, because to me, it's just very close. It's just, you know, it's just a very close case.
Well, you know, and in this one, because of the tragedy of it resulting in a death and the circumstances that are going on right now in our country, as you said, things don't happen in a vacuum. And I think that there is a lot of influence because of sort of the times we're in right now, everything that happened with Floyd, then you have these different things that are going on with police violence and how that's viewed and defund the police and blah, blah, blah. And I think all of this contributes to why Daniel Penny was charged. But on the other side of that, how interesting is it that they have raised over, I think the last time I looked, $3 million. And that's just the last time I looked, which, you know, several months ago, for his defense.
Wow.
Did him the best defense he could have. Literally, just a GoFundMe set up. I mean, the donor sizes of these contributions are tens of thousands of dollars from individual donors alone. And when you amass everything given to him, $3 million for his defense fund, I think that says something.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And because, and I think it goes back to like what I just said, is it's such a close deal. You got arguments on both sides, right? Because again, anybody who was in that situation or thought they may be in that situation or had a family member or loved one in that situation would want somebody to step up and defend them, right? If it came down to that. And so, you know, the result of this may be if he gets convicted or people saying, and we already know people kind of have that attitude, I don't want to be involved. But it even pushes it, I don't want to be involved because I don't want to be prosecuted, right? If I step in, if I shove this guy, he falls and hits his head, right? Not even, we're not talking about a carotid restraint or a chokehold here. We're talking about, hey, if I just step up and say, hey, man, move back and push him, and he stumbles over a seat on the train and hits his head on a bar, one of the rails, right? Then am I going to be charged for murder? And so you got it, so it puts that into how do we as a society, right? How do we want to look at these things? And on the other hand, you want to say you don't want vigilante justice, right? You don't want people, you know, jumping into situations and doing something and then it's a very very interesting and close deal. That's why I said it's gonna be interesting to see how the jury accepts the evidence. I mean, on the surface, it seems fairly simple, right? There's this 5 or 6 minutes that this happens on the train, and you know everything is contained in a training car, right? There's no, it's not probably going to be a whole bunch that comes from the outside. At least I haven't heard of anything from the outside that would influence this trial. It's going to be everything that happened within those few minutes within inside of that subway car that leads to this verdict, to the witnesses and all of those things. So it's going to be very interesting.
It's really going to be interesting to see how well the defense does of bringing out the emotion of, you know, how upset, the fear, you know, those witnesses. To right. me, if that doesn't come alive in the courtroom, I think Daniel Penny could really be in a lot of trouble. Do you think Daniel Penny should testify?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think he should, because like you said, putting my on the defense side, like you said, the key to me to the defense is just what you said, is putting witnesses up to say that they were afraid, right? You can't do just him by saying, well, I was afraid for her. It's going to have to be other people saying, yeah, I was afraid. I didn't know what this guy was going to do. And the young lady, right? The young lady who was actually, he was defending, having her come and testify. And then I think he has to take the stand because his defense team will want to, one, you know, all the stuff in the media, you want to make him into a human being. You make him into a person, right? He's being portrayed, you know, he's a former Marine, he's all this and all that in the media. Well, people have a different, what's the right word, vision of that or a different idea of what that is. Well, he's a young kid, right? You know, he's a young kid at the time, like 20 years old. So you want to put that and show him who he is on the stand. And introduce him to the jury as such and say, hey, look, young man, he's on his way to wherever, didn't intend for this to happen. It happened. He acted because of what you heard from these other witnesses. They were in fear. He was in fear that this woman was going to be assaulted. And he felt that if he didn't do anything, he could end up getting hurt. So, yeah, I don't see there's in my mind, and I'm not an attorney, there's no way he can hurt himself by testifying, right? I don't know if it's in his background or anything that, I mean, so as a defense attorney, yeah, the defense wants to put him up there, right? They want to portray him as this patriotic guy who served his country, who's, and then even as a civilian stepped in to do the right thing when he thought it had to be done.
And the opposite of that, if I'm the prosecutor, oh my gosh, I want to dial down on, listen, Jordan Neely never hurt a fly. Yes, he's got mental issues. Yes, he's homeless. But a lot of people knew him. I think they're going to bring in people from that neighborhood and so on and so forth to say, listen, this is, he impersonated Michael Jordan. You know, there's a lot of really interesting and cute pictures of him, quite frankly, of him, you know, singing and dancing and doing his thing. And so I think they're going to want to portray him as somebody that was really harmless.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And maybe so, you know, again, not a psychiatrist or psychologist here, but you're dealing with somebody who had a mental illness, right? And they're probably, I'm sure, when he was medicated and he was fine, and like you said, he was this street performer, right? I guess that's kind of was his gig. He was like Michael Jackson songs and singing and doing all that and entertaining people. And, you know, it's a tragedy that this happened because maybe there was some mental illness or there have been some outside drugs or whatever that caused him to have this fit of rage during that period of time. And it intersected with Daniel Penny being on the subway at the same time and in those actions. But in my opinion, you can't hold Penny to knowing his background, right? Knowing that, hey, he's just really this, you know, sweet, tall, lanky guy who's a street performer. You can't hold him to that because he's just a passenger on the train trying to go from one place to another. And then all these other things happen while he's on the train and he does what he thought he had to do, and, you know, and like I said, I think it's going to go back to how long he held him in the hold, and the witnesses, the guys, or ladies that were around him assisting him, that they say we didn't see anything wrong, and we thought it was okay because they were the ones that were there, right? They were there. They're gonna be the ones to say, you know, he helped us or he was doing the right thing. I think that's going to play a big part of it. I think it's a really tough case for the prosecution just because of that. Unless these witnesses, and I haven't heard anything where anybody said, now I did hear some witnesses said, hey man, you need to let, you know, you're going to choke him, you're going to, you know, let it go or something like that. So I'm sure they'll have some of those witnesses to say, hey, did you think that he had held him long enough? But again, if you put anybody up there with any type of, even the police officers that testify, right, to ask them about their defensive tactics training, right? If you let this guy go, you don't know what's going to happen. So is that something that they would have done, right? If that was defense, I would ask them. But I don't know, like I'm sure there may be some police officers that testify, but they got there after the fact, right? I don't know how much they can add to the actual incident.
I think too, DJ, a big determining factor besides your points you made, which are so spot on, it comes down to the jurors that were selected. I think Vordire in this case was so important. I mean, I'm going to want to see on that jury individuals that can relate to this Marine. You know, mothers that have children in the military, that have spouses in the military, anything with a military nexus, that's who I'm going to want on the jury. Meanwhile, the prosecution is going to want to get, you know, people from this neighborhood. He was from Harlem. They're going to want that type of, you know, culture and influx in this jury. What do you think about that? Do you think the jurors are going to play a crucial role in terms of their backgrounds?
Yeah. Yeah, always, right? In any trial, as you know, it's Vordire is always a tricky deal, right? Trying to get the jury or quote unquote the right jury, right? Whether you're the defense or the prosecution, and that is going to be interesting. The type of juror that you want, right? Like you said, obviously people, these male people in the military or have been in the military, that'll be one type. But even, I think, people who ride the train and are just passengers and have fear of something like this happening to them, right? They don't have to necessarily have that background. They, you just may want them on the jury to say, hey, would you want someone to intercede for you in this type of situation, right? And so, again, that's why I just think it's kind of a tough case for the prosecution, right? You've ridden the subway in New York. We've all been in those situations, and we would all say probably, yeah, they got to that situation where I thought I was being attacked or somebody was being attacked. I want somebody to intercede. You don't want anybody to die from it, but I would want somebody to intercede. And I think that's what he has going for him in this whole deal is that he didn't chase the guy onto the subway. He wasn't going after him, right? He just happened to be there, just like so many other thousands, in New York, almost million people a day on a subway train.
So, DJ, your needle, if you will, is going toward, you think he's going to get acquitted?
Yeah. And again, just obviously just based on what I've read in the media, I just think it's really going to be hard for them to convict him. The only thing that gives me pause is the length of time, right, and what the witnesses will say. Was he still struggling? Had he gone limp or anything like that? And I haven't seen any of that in the accounts that I've read, but something like that would say, okay, hey, at that point, maybe you should have let him go. But if it's consistent with, hey, he's still struggling, he's holding him because he's still struggling, I just think it's going to be difficult. It's going to be, and as you know, right, you only need benefit of that. You only need one person, right, to get acquitted, right? Whereas you need all 12 to say, yeah, we could, and that's, again, that plays into his favor because I think there's going to be people on that jury that say, you know, we don't like the fact that the kid died, but we don't think this guy is necessarily responsible for it. It's his actions that caused him to react. And so all you need is one or two people to feel that way. So I would say, yeah, I think he's going to get acquitted.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Not to be acquitted, but to have it be a hung jury, which I agree with you, will serve as to being acquitted, essentially.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if it's hung and they say, listen, we can't come to terms with the unanimous verdict, then I don't think the state will retry this. No way. That's just my opinion, not this particular case. I could be wrong. But one person.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You're probably right. That would be a tough one to try again. And again, I mean, his background, again, based on what I've read, and I've read everything about it, when I say his, Kenny's background, it's just nothing there that you're going to say. I mean, they can't portray him, right, as a bad guy. I don't see anything. They have to stick with the facts of this incident. This is what happened on that day, on this train, right? In those, you know, 5, 6, 8 minutes, however long that incident took. And based on that, it's, yeah, if they can't get a conviction the first time out, what else could you add to it, right? What else could you
do? I know I agree with you. Hey, listen, I want to look and just see if there's any questions we want to entertain. Yeah, I mean, people are just talking about it was accidental death. They're agreeing. They're talking about the liability of possibly public transportation. Dr. Miller points out it's an accidental death for sure. Just a lot of good points that I think we pointed out. And, you know, our listeners are saying, listen, we kind of agree. And I think that's to your point. I always say this, DJ, you're never going to serve on a jury. I'm never going to serve on a jury. We're never going to be picked. It's people like the listeners, true crimers, people who are nurses and, you know, other professions, teachers. That's who are on juries. And they're people like right here. So it's very interesting, I think, that many people have the same sentiments that you and I do as laymen. Yeah. But DJ, I'm going to take you to one other quick topic, which I know the people in chat, I think, will like. I want to touch on really quickly Delphi. Now, DJ doesn't know about the Delphi per se, but there was a particular motion that happened that Judge Gohl, the Delphi case involves two little girls, Abby Williams and Libby German, 13 and 14, who were murdered at the Monongah Bridge in Indiana back 7 years ago. The case went unsolved until about 2 years ago when they arrested a local CBS clerk for slashing their throats, for making them naked. We don't know whether they undressed each other, whether he undressed them. We don't know how it happened. And then murdering them, no sexual assault, but clearly a sexual event. And the FBI got involved about a month after the incident, way too late in my estimation, after much of the evidence had been missed, had not been properly collected, in my view. And there's an FBI agent that the defense wants to put on the stand who has exculpatory information they believe very relevant to the case. And what happened was that the judge, okay, so here's the motion. I'm just going to read it. Comes now the defendant, Richard Allen, by counsel, blah, blah, blah. The defense sent a subpoena to Supervisory Special Agent Adam Pohl of the FBI. Adam Pohl is currently the election crime coordinator for the FBI in San Antonio. SSA Pohl's duty include overseeing the FBI San Antonio's command post for the 2024 election. SSA Pohl is a necessary witness for the defense. However, it's anticipated that his testimony will be no longer than 30 minutes. It's extremely difficult for SSA Pohl to appear in person at these proceedings, given his current job and responsibilities. The Indiana State Administrative Rule says you can testify remotely for good cause. The judicial economy and expense warrants this request. The defense respectfully asks for SSA Pohl to appear remotely. I believe the state of Indiana, that the state of Indiana objects to the motion. So Judge Gohl today ruled, we're not going to do this remotely. If he's not here, he's not going to be able to testify. And my position today on Twitter throughout the day has been that is baloney in terms of Pohl not coming. And supposedly there was some testimony or something came out in trial that Pohl is too sick to fly, SSA Pohl. Of course, I said he's too sick to fly, then he's too sick to carry a gun and to manage a command post.
What?
Give me your thoughts here, DJ. You ever heard of something like this?
No. To answer your question succinctly, I would say no. My thoughts are, yeah, I would agree with you. Baloney is the word you use. I might use a stronger term. But, yeah, I mean, I don't see why if he needs to go testify, he should be able to go testify. I mean, obviously, he's a supervisor. Election, you know, he's running a command post, right? And you and I have talked about this, but, you know, San Antonio office, I'm sure there are plenty of other supervisory agents that can run the command post in his 1 or maybe 2 day absence. Election fraud is not a reactionary crime, right? You're not going to run out that night and then somebody says, hey, we got an election fraud in progress. The FBI has to come solve it, right? That's not how it works. So him not being there for a day or two is not going to change that investigation. And there are plenty of, again, agents that can handle that in his absence, as you and I know. So, yeah, there's no reason for him not to go testify. And, you know, I kind of agree with the judge. He needs to be there in person. I mean, you know, you got to write your face reviews and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you want a serious crime or serious charge like this, you want the witnesses there so they can be cross-examined and so the jury can see them and judge for themselves whether they're credible, right? That's part of seeing somebody in person in the courtroom. The jury is making a determination of whether or not we believe this person and if they're a credible witness. So with all those things in mind, yeah, I mean, he should go. I mean, if he's too sick to, he's too sick to man the command post, if he's too sick to fly, right? You can't have it both ways. If he's too sick to fly, you can't man the command post. So it's one or the other. And here's the other deal. From the court standpoint, if the defense thinks he's that important of a witness, they can put it off for a day, right? He doesn't have to testify on Tuesday, tomorrow, the 5th. He testify Wednesday or Thursday, right? You know, I'm sure it won't be convenient for everybody. I know the judge wants to get the trial over with as quickly as possible, but hey, you know, elections don't happen, or national elections or presidential elections don't happen every year. So this is just a one-off situation where the federal election, and maybe you can put it off for a day or two and say, hey, get up here, you know, we're going to put you on the stand Wednesday at 2 o'clock. So leave Wednesday, from San Antonio Wednesday morning, get up here Wednesday afternoon and testify. So, I think there are ways to work around this. I don't see why this should be a huge deal on either part. I'm sure, as you know as I know, he probably just doesn't want to go. Right?
That's so, exactly.
Yeah, he just doesn't want to go.
I don't know what he's got going on, but this, a man's life is in the balance here.
Exactly. Yeah.
Of his natural life. This will be likely, if he's found guilty, he will be sentenced life without the possibility of parole.
Right. And
he can't pull himself away for one day is absurd. Boy, I'm really putting it out there, DJ, but you and I know how ridiculous that is. Even if somebody blows up a ballot box, that takes the you know, whoever's in charge of that command post saying, all right, I need agents, blah, 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 hook up with the ATF and get out there. I mean, I'm just saying it in a nutshell. That's right. How it works.
Right. Yeah. And like you said, and you know, so if the guy's found guilty, then this may be grounds for appeal, right? You don't want to give him that leverage if you think, well, the guy's guilty or whatever, you know, so go up there, testify. So there is, you eliminate that there is no ground to say, hey, this guy had evidence and they refused to testify. It's going to give him grounds for an appeal. So I want to eliminate that. Just get it over with and go up there, do your testimony. Like I said, you probably won't be on the stand for an hour and it'll be over with. But yeah, this is not a, in my opinion, not a valid excuse. I don't know if you remember, Jennifer, real quick. There was a situation where you had a case and I was on leave. I had to come back to testify. You remember that?
Yeah,
It was a felon in possession.
But yeah. You know, DJ, there's so many like that. I was at the FBI Academy and you were a class ahead of me, but I had to leave. I was so upset because it was the day that we got to go see the director.
Right, the day you could go to D.C., go visit the director, yeah.
And I was under grand jury subpoena from my previous time as a special agent with the Office of Inspector General. And so I missed the whole thing. That was kind of a big thing, right? It was like a field day out with everybody and missed a couple of other things. But, you know, I wasn't happy about it. But, I mean, we're talking about justice, the whole reason why we're there. The thought is that this agent is somehow incapacitated and can't fly. I don't know, because guess what? They didn't put it in the motion. I read the entire motion there for that purpose to say, listen, if it's truly a health issue, that's what you put in your motion. Right. Don't pull this nonsense about he's too busy at a command post, which we all know we are so irreplaceable, DJ. We are.
I always joke, you know, we have the name badges, you know, Special Agent Jennifer Kaufendorfer, Special Agent Daryl Dean, and they slide in and out of those little placards you put on your desk. And I say, you know, there's a reason they slide in and out. So they can slide somebody else's name in, because you're not irreplaceable. Like, they just slide somebody else in and the bureau will be fine and it's going to keep running with or without you. So, yeah, this guy could, and especially, like I said, for a day or two. They could life will go on without him. I'm sure he takes leave or right, sick leave or whatever, that he's replaceable then. So he's replaceable to go testify.
And I wanted to say one more thing about this that I'm not sure people are thinking about, but I know working with different judges, they take a huge offense. And I think that's what's happened with Judge Gohl. And listen, I'm not a Judge Gohl fan in this case. And there's so many points of appeal, DJ. I know you don't know this case, but there's so many points of appeal already. But I'm not a Judge Gohl fan, but I would be offended too, because she's no idiot. She's been around the block for decades. She's been in this business. She's been an attorney. She's been a judge. And she knows that if an FBI agent is under subpoena, they have to come out. And this flim-flam excuse of the, you know, election, you know, running the command post is so ridiculous. He goes to lunch. He has, there's multiple people that run a command post, for those of you who don't know it. You're not the guy. Typically, there's at least two guys because you do 12, 24-hour coverage. So it's
Eight and eight. Yeah, you're going to have two or three supervisory special agents that are in charge of the command post at any 8-hour interval or whatever, right? Like I said, it's a 24-hour command post. And the San Antonio office has plenty of supervisory special agents. One could step in and fill in for this one while he's traveling back to testify, right? So,
and it's San Antonio. It's Texas. That election was decided months ago. It's not like this is Pennsylvania, right?
Right. And I worked election law clients. Like I said, I understand that this, again, like you said, this is not a reactionary crime where, you know, like a bank robbery, kidnapping, you got to run out that night and get to it. It's going to be a, hey, like you said, we're going to send somebody out and we'll get the evidence, we'll investigate it, because it's just generally that's not how it's handled. So, and again, there's plenty of agents that can go out and do that are well trained and can handle that. So I don't know why he doesn't want to go, or maybe it's a prosecution deal. Maybe the attorneys don't want him to come. They're saying, you don't want an excuse not to come. And that's what they're using is, run the command post.
You're going to, a lot of people are going to love that you said that, DJ, because they believe that there's a lot going on behind the scenes. DJ, I have taken up almost an hour of your Monday evening here, and I just really want to thank you for joining me again with your expertise and your background. I've always just looked so much up to you as my ATL and as friends. So thank you so much for coming on and lending us your expertise.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Very interesting topic, interesting conversation.
All right. We'll keep in touch on it.
Okay, take care.
All the best. Everybody, I just love DJ. DJ is no nonsense. He has been around forever. He knows his stuff. Somebody that I'd go through a door with and did go through a door with on multiple occasions anywhere. He's the type that has your back. And I think he made it clear, you know, that at least from everything he knows, and I know he's really studied up on this case, the Daniel Penny case, was a case of a good Samaritan really trying to do the right thing, and things went horribly, horribly wrong in that moment. And I really hope justice prevails in this. I haven't heard all the testimony. Obviously, it's closed because we're talking New York. And so under their law, they're not going to have cameras in the courtroom. We're going to have to depend, just like in Delphi, on what's related through social media, mainstream media. I find it kind of interesting, I think, because Delphi is going on. Nobody's really talking about this case. But this case has huge implications. It has huge implications because already people are afraid to help. Already people are afraid to come to the assistance of others. And if Daniel Penny is convicted, I can't imagine any good Samaritan wanting to risk going to prison to try to stop somebody who's going to harm a baby, like in this case, or otherwise hurt passengers. I want to thank you all for being here. Thank you to my mods, who are the best in the business. They're unbelievable. on here and also behind the scenes. If you did like the program, I hope you press like and I hope you subscribe. And I appreciate each of you for spending your Monday evening with us. Till next time, may justice be served.